one of the things that's always put against marijuana is that it destroys short-term, or it destroys your memory. Well, I dare say I have a prodigious memory, and I'm the heaviest smoker I've ever known, and my memory for dates, names of painters, writers, literary and scientific minutiae, odd vocabularies in specialized areas is very great, and I don't credit cannabis with that, but I certainly can't believe that it has damaged my ability to do this. Now, it is true that sometimes in a conversation you will lose your thread, but on the other hand, it gives you an equal power to brilliantly fake the situation and to pick up the thread and re-stitch together the narrative. The other point I might make that we haven't mentioned yet, or two points actually, is that I think it gives an extraordinary verbal facility. And this is actually what won me to it in the first place. My reputation as a public speaker is based on my supposedly dazzling oratorical abilities, but I come out of a peer group, a carass in Berkeley, where everyone was able to do what I do. Everyone seemed to be able to hold forth for hours on the most arcane subjects. And in fact, when I got into cannabis, the style of doing it that I enjoyed most was I ran a kind of cannabis salon, as it were. And people came and they smoked and they talked and talked and talked.
Gentlemen.
You're having a nightmare. What if it's true?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Alan, it's a possibility, isn't it?
The very word secrecy is repugnant.
Secrets.
In a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, the secret oaths, and the secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers,
constant, extreme danger,
which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restriction. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger,
extreme danger,
that an announced need for increased security.
This is Conspiracy Queries with Alan Carr.
Will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control.
You're crazy!
And no officious, high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes.
Isn't the Pentagon suspicious that all the buildings would blow up?
Or to withhold from the press and the public?
I think you're just looking at things for the first time.
The facts they deserve to know.
You've had your whole fucking life to think things over. What good's a few minutes more gonna do you now?
The facts they deserve to know. They deserve to know. deserve to know.
Welcome to Green Crush Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park on this rainy, rainy Tuesday. Have we got some good news for you? The gentleman smuggler is here. Going to tell us how to raise our fist.
Facts they deserve to know.
Move to an achieve an elevated existence. Raise your fist.
Barry Foy. Barry Foy is here. You ever heard of Barry Foy? Well, if you've ever smoked a joint, you should be on your knees thanking the good Lord that Barry Foy ever walked this earth. He's a smuggler and a gentleman. He's a gentleman smuggler in a group of gentlemen smugglers and has been so kind to come on our show today and talk about his journey through the legal system of cannabis. Well, they used to call it marijuana, weed, bud, shake, chuff, all kinds of things. And Barry used to get it somehow. All right, we're doing that, thanks. And he used to bring it up to the United States of America. In boats, in airplanes. Sounds like a lot of fun. Hey, but it ended with doing some time, so you'll be the judge of whether that was worth it or not. In your own personal way, I, of course, will be, I can't really do the show here kneeling, but I'm so grateful to these gentlemen. Spoke with Barry a little last night on the phone just to make sure we knew what we were doing. We were plugged in okay, and it's all hooked up. It's always exciting to do that, and so now Barry will be on the show with us today. I'm so excited about this, and here's a book. I'm going to hold it up here. He didn't write the book. He's just in it. It's called Jackpot. Are we seeing this? Yeah, Jackpot. High Times, High Seas, and the Sting that Launched the War on Drugs by Jason Ryan. I think this came out in 2012. And Wall Street Journal bestseller. Something's going on there. So we'll be talking to Barry shortly. He's standing by, and the tales this man can tell, and I just can't say enough about it, because he's at one end of the spectrum when it was all crazy and illegal and nuts, and here we are four decades on, using it as a medicine. When they'll let us, when they'll believe us, but that's not always the case, not in Canada anyway. So we will start here, and we will be going around the world touching on a lot of different areas. Thanks for listening. To episode, what are we doing here? This is episode 106, is that right? Yeah, episode 106, Conspiracy Queries, episode 34, Green Crush. Hey, isn't that neat? Break them down, they both tally up to 7. How did that happen? Just like last week was 6 and next week will be 8. Also like to say hello to Capstone Broadcasting. Capstone Broadcasting, available on your local internet. You can find them there talking about all kinds of cool things, mostly to do with, well, it's called Capstone Broadcasting, at Capstone Broadcasting, and they have a lot of fantastic information on their website, and their testing is out today, having a listen. They're going to throw our feed out to some of you folks that might not have been listening already. As well as Capstone, we have Blunthouse Media, at Blunthouse Media. Another great page and organization. Also on the internet. You know, they say the internet's full of junk. That's only half true. It's only half full of junk. And you have to be discerning enough and aware enough to find the good stuff. So once again, Blunthouse Media, at Blunthouse Media, and at Capstone Broadcasting, on board today for the listen with Barry. Now, it's funny we're starting off with Barry Foy. I have another story here we're going to get to first. In the news, you might have heard about the dead billionaire. He worked for a company, owned and ran a company called Apotex Pharmaceuticals. And this guy was the head of that particular outfit and owned it. I believe he started it. I don't know much about it. I'm not a huge fan of the organization. I'm just saying. Get off my case. He's no longer with us because sometime before Christmas of 2017, him and his wife were found murdered inside their very expensive palatial home in northern Toronto. He's a Canadian guy. He was a Canadian guy. And right away, the police said there was no sign of foul play. Later on, they found them both hanging in their pool by the, you know, those bars you use to go down the ladder, the little ladder at the deep end? They were hanging from those kind of things in the pool. Supposed to be a murder-suicide. A bit awkward, I think, if you're going to go about it that way. Here, I'm just going to slip this around your neck, and then you'll die, and then I'll go over here and slip it around my neck, and then I'll die. A lot of suicides are suspicious. And still, people were like, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. Well, it turns out, as they do more investigating, there sure is more of a conspiracy angle. They decided things were in impossible positions and things weren't quite playing out. Of course, Toronto police is having a tough time now. They said a serial killer wasn't a serial killer, and then he was able to continue killing, and now they're saying they weren't really saying he wasn't a serial killer. Mark Saunders, chief of Toronto. Good Lord. This guy's also in charge of all the dispensary busting that never seems to do anything positive as well. But the police have found that Barry Sherman, this 70-ish billionaire, a year before that killing, he had agreed to work with a firm called CanTrust to produce a slow-release medical marijuana pill that would treat chronic pain, depression, and PTSD, and more, it says. It's funny how when pharmacy wants to use it, it can so be applicable to many different illnesses. But when you're just talking about using cannabis oil or the benefits of cannabis straight up, they'll tell you, well, it's not good for all those things. That's crazy. Well, you're nuts thinking it's... Because they're using the pharmaceutical model where everything's targeted for one specific illness and one disease. You got high cholesterol, you take Lipitor. You're depressed, you take an antidepressant. You got Crohn's disease, you take a Crohn's disease medicine. All this bifurcation of available medication causing an inflation of our economic situation, including the fatness of the wallets in the pockets of the top. But those guys don't always get to live. Here's this poor Barry. Barry Sherman. And if he was a straight-up cannabis purveyor and they found him killed in his home, they would have said, oh, look, that's the kind of trouble you get when you lead such a lifestyle. Oh, my God. But we didn't hear any of that until just now, since just before Christmas, and now we're almost into April here. And seems to be that Barry Sherman's pot pill that he wanted to invent. And why did you have to do that, sir? Have you not just tried the actual plant? Why do these folks... to make a profit. Right, sorry, forgot. Others felt the pot pill could be a game changer in the industry, and they also felt it could be a disruptor to Big Pharma. So there's a motive there, once again, the monetary motive for Pharma or whoever they hire, some kind of hitman, Ray Donovan kind of bullshit, I don't know. Barry Sherman said to the executives around the boardroom table, it makes sense, let's do it. This is a year before he was murdered. No longer suicide murder. To the project to develop a slow-release medical marijuana pill was on. Just a year before the murder, Sherman gave the green light. And they were going to call it the pharmaceuticalization of marijuana. So it's not exactly that I'm mourning his absence. Just want to be clear. Now I'm not dancing around with glee on his grave. That wouldn't be of any kind of taste, would it? But I'm not exactly disappointed that Barry didn't get to do this. And it looks like the pharmaceutical cartel once again has a potential murder victim. I mean, this is a lot of money. People keep thinking it's a crazy notion to think there's any kind of a pharmaceutical cartel conspiracy. But my God, folks, how Pied Piper of Hamelin are you? Take the horse blinders off. Pay attention to things. For example, like how medical marijuana can help people. Thanks for listening. If you're just joining us, this is Green Crush with Alan Park. Let me just reset what's going on. What's green? Cannabis. What's the crush? Well, aside from the way the front end of the show starts now, and there's so much stuff going on there, the crush is actually designed to impart the notion that properly used, cannabis can crush illness. My own being a drastic aggressive advanced case of stage 4 cancer detected in 2013. No chance for survival. They didn't even want to get me on the chemo, the radiation, the surgery. I was, quote-unquote, too far gone. I didn't really want to do chemo, but to hear you're not eligible for it, it sends a chill through your bones, or what's left of the rapidly metastasizing bones, that there was no possible way I could have stopped. And here I am, 3 years and 4 months past my guaranteed funeral. And I'm talking about these things all the time because I will not stop talking about these things until more people realize what's going on. Well-read, learned people who understand the medical importance of cannabis. And that must be why they're legalizing it in Canada, right? That must be the main thing. So we had the senators here debating the marijuana bill. Has to be read 3 times. It has to be passed 3 times. It survived its second reading, but my God, you should hear these unread, moronic idiots who believe cannabis does this, and they were saying this. Well, I believe that, hey, to hell with your beliefs. Why don't you look some of this stuff up? Why don't you talk to some people who have survived, and never mind that, championed a terrible illness? There are loads of us. I'm not the only one. I just found that out when I was coming out of the other side of the barrel. But who do they go to first? They go to the cops. Hey, you guys aren't going to have as many man hours if we legalize this. What can we do to help you? I know, we'll just drop a bunch more laws and call it legal when it's just merely recriminalized. Sad to know I've had some back and forths on Facebook this week recently with some friends and compadres of mine who are completely fine that the government's going to be completely running this monopoly. You know they're going to do it anyway, is the general tone. Yeah, I guess they're going to do it if we just sit back and let them. Complacency is a bit of a disease. You have to use cannabis probably to get your way around that. But listen to these guys. The senators were saying things like this. One female senator here, she said that she doesn't like cannabis because it's so dangerous. You know, you just take 4 tokes and that's equivalent to smoking 5 grams. Now, I don't know how large this woman's lungs are, but it sounds like about 18 times the size of her gray matter brain. If you're familiar with a quarter, that's 3.5 grams. Add a gram and a half to that and tell me you're going to huff that down in 4 tokes. This is a senator debating on the logistics and the legitimacy of this substance, and she clearly knows nothing about it. So right at the moment they're passing the second reading, you know, not 3 months ago, 6, 8, 10 months ago, you know, not taking the actual information from the fact-finding mission that they had in Ottawa to get to the bottom of the science. And all of this stuff was brought forward by Dana Larson, by Jody Emery. Lots of people testified. These idiots weren't listening. So Chris Selly in the National Post says, here's something I bet you didn't know. Bill C-45, the Liberals' marijuana legislation, allows children between 12 and 17 to possess up to 5 grams of cannabis. Sounds crazy, right? The whole stated goal of the project was to keep it out of children's hands, yet no lesser authorities than conservative senators Ton Hyndgo and Pierre, a French name that's eluding my tongue right now, along with their leader in the upper chamber, Senator Larry Smith, and Justin Trudeau appointed independent Senator Marie-Francoise Mégie, a physician and former professor, insisted in a debate that it is so, that those are the facts, that you can have less than up to 5 grams without getting into trouble with kids. If a minor consumed all 5 grams in a given day, that could mess them up good and proper. Imagine looking out a classroom of 12 to 13-year-old children all permitted to have 5 grams of pot on their desks, Smith demanded. No one's going to do that, though, Smith. No one's coming in and plunking it down on their desk and going, I get to have this. Try some more fear-mongering. In an otherwise blithering address to the Red Chamber, Senator David Wells at least gave away what on earth his colleagues were talking about, that youth ages 12 to 17 will be able to possess up to 5 grams of dried cannabis before facing criminal charges. And he contended this was hidden away in the bill. And he called it shocking. Trudeau appointed independent Senator Francis Lankin suggested that it wasn't hidden at all, and as much as he cited its location and asked whether he would prefer children aged 12 to 17 to be subject to criminal sanctions for small-scale possession. But basically, they have to send this bill back now, and there are so many problems with it. We've gotten into it a bunch on previous shows, but they have to change it. They have to make amendments. Here's one of the things I'd like to change. You know, when they have these Captain Morgan commercials and any kind of alcoholic beverage commercial, it's always a fun time. Chicks in bikinis, you're on a boat having a great time, running around on the beach. It's a Budweiser kind of picnic. Hey, spring break. Hey, let's get hammered. Meanwhile, alcohol is actually an expensive, damaging depressant for your body, proffered by the government and profited from by the government. But the weed packaging they're going to have here in cannabis is basically one thing. It's either a white or black package. It's got the name on it of the company in the small corner and a big red stop sign with the letters THC on there. Get away from this. I know I talked about it last week, but nobody else is talking about it. It needs to be brought forward. So the legal weed producers are kind of unhappy over these new cannabis packaging rules because the only thing that's going to distinguish your company is this little tiny thing in the corner, little logo of your company in the corner. Otherwise, it looks identical. The hypocrisy is incredible, particularly from a bunch of people who consider themselves to be the shepherds of democracy, trying to live in a democratic world, trying to bring democracy to other countries around the world at force and with tanks and invasions. But in this case, when most people want access to this thing, they have to dream up a series of rules that negates the very idea that there's an actual democracy going on here. Boring packaging, THC, keep away, it's in the red stop sign. Why they won't just teach the children in the school at the time? Yeah, bring your 5 grams to school, Billy. Let's put it on a scale and let's break down what these are. Oh, those are called trichomes. Now let's get into the science of THC. Now let's get into the science of terpenes and other cannabinoids. Now let's get into the science of CBDs and let's tell them about it. But these schools don't bloody well prepare you for life. They don't tell you how to get a job. They don't tell you what money is, how it works, how to get a mortgage and a house. All the regular shit you need to do to live your life in this society, that's not in there. So, of course, be fearmongers. And keep our access away from the kids at all. The kids are going to get this thing. Teach them about it. You got these schools, remember? Everybody has to be vaccinated to go. Can't be that scary. Such hypocrisy. Now, our beautiful BC, where we get most of our fantastic Canadian bud, it says they may want to look to Colorado's experience as illegal cannabis still flourishes. This is the inherent problem of having these laws the way they set them up. While they say they're trying to stamp out the black market, they just keep taking steps that reinforce it. And they bloody well know this, too. So something's at foot here. British Columbians preparing for the approaching legalization of recreational weed may want to look to Colorado, says here on the CBC website, where 4 years of legal pot have come with a dramatic increase in criminal cannabis operations, according to law enforcement officials. Glenn Gash was the agent in charge of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration field office in Grand Junction, Colorado, until he retired. And said that in 2014, he watched the number of seizures of cannabis skyrocket. Our black market has increased 20-fold. And Canada's on the same old plan to make sure that the bad guys don't get it and that the kids don't get it. And they keep making decisions that that reinforce that there that will be going on. So somebody's happy about that. Let's get the hell out of Canada then. And I'm working on that, folks. I am working on that. I'm really tired of the... There's a lot of sheep up here. A lot of folks won't even believe a fact right in their face if it counters their preconception. So let's go to England. Sick kids petition pressures the UK government. A sick kids petition is pressuring the UK government to legalize. Now, we've had this in Australia. Jenny Hallam might be going to jail. We've had this in Ireland. Vera Toomey fought the system and won and now has one of four only permits in Ireland for medical cannabis for her little daughter, who's doing quite well, by the way, using this stuff. When nothing else works. Dravet syndrome. all kinds of seizures. It says here in CannabisNow.com, turned down by the British government when they requested permission to use cannabis oil, the family of a child epilepsy sufferer personally delivered a petition with thousands of signatures to 10 Downing Street, home of the Prime Minister. Charges of hypocrisy on the part of government were brought into sharp focus by revelations that the Home Office Minister, ultimately responsible for the decision to turn down the request, is married to a businessman working for GW Pharmaceuticals. So when you find out what GW Pharmaceuticals is, you understand that this is a drastic conflict of interest. Hey, let my husband get rich while your kid gets sick and maybe dies. Six-year-old Alfie Dingley. I hope that's how you pronounce it. Could be Dingley. I'm not sure. Alfie Dingley, hoisted on his dad's shoulders, was at the head of a small march that advanced on 10 Downing Street, seat of Britain's governments, on March 20th, holding banners that said Alfie's Hope. Marchers supported the boy as he presented a petition demanding he be granted a special license to use medical cannabis to treat his epilepsy. Got 370,000 people on that petition. It was delivered by the little boy himself and his mother, Hannah Deacon. As the Manchester Evening News notes, the delegation also included the family's chief ally in Parliament, Jeff Smith, representing the Manchester suburb of Withington, who is an outspoken advocate for sweeping overhauls of Britain's drug laws. When they arrived at 10 Downing Street, they met the Prime Minister, Theresa May. Oh, God, isn't that nice to see her in the flesh? And Minister of State Nick Hurd, who assured them a resolution would be reached. For just one kid? Or you're going to understand that this stuff isn't just a medicine for one kid. This stuff is a food. It's for your endocannabinoid system. You're supposed to be taking it in. And you've probably spent your whole life with hardly any of it or not enough of it. You've been starving yourself. You likely have a cannabis deficiency. Right, Dr. Michelle Ross, who will be getting back to us soon from her trip of a fact-finding nature in Portugal. It's a food, folks. It's really simple. It's a food that normalizes your body to the point where disease just can't seem to take hold. It doesn't cure the disease. It just renders your body into a place where disease has a much tougher time getting started or developing. So here's a billionaire Brit, a fellow from Virgin. Richard Branson says that as a member of the Global Commission of Drug Policy, I've long advocated for fundamental reform to end the failed global war on drugs. A monstrosity of ill intentions. Poor judgment. Bad policy. That's cost hundreds of thousands of lives and billions in taxpayer money. All for nothing, because here we still are at the precipice of everybody gets to use it. So Branson's trying to get something going on. He's talking about he wants to get global trade and illegal drugs entirely controlled with criminal organizations out of here. And a world awash in a greater drug supply than ever before. I know what Barry was up to. We're not worried about Barry anymore. Barry's not around, but his company is still around, and so is bloody Monsanto. So check out Richard Branson's Global Commission on Drug Policy and see what he's trying to do. He's also supported Alfie Dingley, this billionaire Richard Branson. His family had to take him to Holland. They had to leave their own country to use a plant to change his health. Incredible. Let's see what we have here.
As a parent and grandparent, I find this case truly heartbreaking. I can't imagine the anguish of the family, Alfie's family, as he's taken into hospital yet again with another ghastly, life-threatening seizure. They went to Holland and they took prescribed medical cannabis. And this treatment worked. It worked dramatically. Suddenly, Alfie was only suffering one less severe seizure a month. Before that, it was 150 seizures, which was so severe that he had to be given steroids.
Sure, give him steroids. Give him steroids, even though that wasn't working. So you hear that. You've got 150 seizures a month, and now you have one a month. And I'm sure that one sucks. But it's not as bad as having 149 other ones that month. That's Alfie. Now, Alfie's not the only kid suffering from this. He just has parents that are going for the charge. and I'm going for the charge. And what I'm trying to tell you right now, folks, is that this drug, this terrible demon weed, the courtesy of America's racism, they were able to build it into this thing called marijuana and blame it on the Mexicans. Sound familiar? Some people don't understand how powerful it is because they haven't been in the position of needing it, and they just can't believe it. But some Americans are coming around on this. Here's a guy. He says, I consider it a miracle. Of course you do. Who's saying this? The mayor of a struggling town that's being saved by the cannabis industry. You've heard that bullshit before, right? Where they say, marijuana's never contributed anything to the society, and it's just a bad thing, and people, they shouldn't do it. It's not good for you. And you've got books, and you've got music, and now you've got a mayor saying that this plant is going to turn his town around. It's in Arkansas. Cotton plant mayor Willard C. Ryland told the New York Times, this is what we've been looking for. And what's remarkable is that they came and found us. He's a conservative Christian. But the moral questions around marijuana didn't deter him from jumping on the opportunity to do business. What are the moral obligations? What's the moral obligation of cannabis? What is that? What does that mean exactly? Here's the thing. If you're Christian and you're listening to me now, and I hope that many of you are, because this is an argument you can never win. Flip open your Bible, page 1, Genesis chapter 1. Go to 11 and 12, verses 11 and 12. Read that out. And tell me how that's not not only not moral, it's basically the food that your God is saying that you should be eating for men to have as nutrition. That's what it is, folks. The seed that reproduces after itself. There's no immoral thing. That's why I hate when people just want to take CBDs and they don't want to take THC when they're remedying their cancer or some horrible disease. You don't just shoot one arrow, man. You got to shoot the whole quiver. Empty that thing. Unload it. This is not a rifle shot. It's a shotgun. Okay? So we've got mayors coming on board. We've got people in officialdom coming on board. Look at this. Maine. The state of Maine just became the first state to protect cannabis use outside of work. Because we have that demonization. Okay, we'll make it legal, but if we find out you ever used it, you're fired. That's regressive, isn't it? Well, employers in Maine can no longer discriminate against employees based on marijuana use during off time. It's crazy they ever could. Workers are now protected from getting fired or disciplined based solely on their use of cannabis in their off time. It's a refreshing display of, quote, if it's legal, it's illegal. The Maine Department of Labor has removed cannabis from the list of substances for which employers may test. Good for Maine and good for Wisconsin. A Wisconsin legislator is going to propose banning marijuana tests for most jobs. Things are turning, folks. Things are turning, and we're kind of done listening to the repression of the folks that say it ain't turning, okay? And I have to say right now that we're going to call up our friend here. He's on the line in South Carolina. And I'm going to give him a ding right now if I don't have too much trouble with it. Hang on. Yeah. It's an incredible time, folks, because these gentlemen here, this man you're about to hear, he is, he was helping us. He brought it in. They took a personal price for this. He actually had to spend some time in jail. We're just calling up Barry right now. Barry, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show. The wonderful tales you're going to hear are going to blow you away. I'm sure this is Barry Foy, also known as Flash. How's it going down there today, Barry? Where are you this morning? South Carolina?
Well, this afternoon, to be exact, we're in Charleston, South Carolina.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah, it is this afternoon. I forgot. Sorry. We're in the same time zone and everything.
That's a good thing.
All right, so listen, I have this book in my hand here, and I didn't get to read the whole thing. I just got it yesterday, but it's called Jackpot. It was written, I guess, in 2010, 2011. Came out in 2012, I suppose. Jason Ryan, you're in here. So I want to just break this down. We're going to take our time and really figure this out. So you were a young man and you had never even smoked a joint at one point. And I want you to kind of get me from the part where you've never tried it before to, you know, it's illegal to now you're bringing it into the country and some of the journeys along the way.
Wow, that's a tall order.
Sure it is. You were there, though.
Yeah, we did it. You know, it's not uncommon, like, to go back and reminisce about what happened back in the late 60s, early 70s. I think it was summertime when I first smoked the joint. And, you know, it wasn't anything fantastic, but it felt good. We had some good laughs, got hungry. And the next thing, you know, the next day we had to try that again and so forth and so on. So it wasn't long before I was in that culture, that group of folks that were, you know, experimenting and reaching out and finding new things to do.
So what are you, a teenager at that point? Is that it?
Looking outside the box. 18, 19, yeah, something like that.
Okay.
And you know, that's how we kind of got started, just like a lot of people back then, probably some Mexican pot, maybe some Panama Red. That was about it. The choices were limited.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about that while we're on topic, Panama Red. And I remember Acapulco Gold. And yeah. I remember when, I think it was Panama Red, but it might have been the Mexican stuff. It was getting sprayed with paraquat. Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, the government was really crazy about trying to figure out a way to stop the production down in Mexico, and so they started spraying with paraquat. That went on, I think, for a year or two, and they finally they were getting a lot of heat for that. Just what they were doing to not only the plants but the environment and the people, the farmers themselves, and it's a poison. It reminds me of Agent Orange in Vietnam.
Right.
You know, just let's defoliate. Let's not leave a leaf unburnt.
And people were getting really messed up who were smoking it, as I recall, right? I mean, it was a big problem if you had paraquat.
Yeah, it did kind of put a scare into some people back in that day. You're absolutely right. They would, like, you know, there was some hesitation.
Yeah.
That was very early on. That was in the early 70s, 70, 71 that was going on, maybe even a little bit later than that, but thank God they quit that that project. The government got shut down on that. But, you know, the government has tried to stop pot in every way they can, and they finally, I think, are just starting to figure out that they can't do that.
It's only taken them 50 years.
Yeah, we the people will overcome. And I think that's kind of what's happening, especially today compared to 30 or 40 years ago. We've come a long way.
We sure have.
And people like you help push that envelope too, man. Don't forget that.
Well, thanks. I didn't really want to be pushing that envelope, but once I realized how effective it was against a fatal stage 4 terminal disease, there wasn't any moral choice other than to start talking about it and bringing it forward. It's not secret kind of stuff, you know.
We need a voice. We need a voice, and you seem to be that voice right now. You cover a lot of really cool subjects and are very informative.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I really am trying to lay out the bones for people to just turn their health around. I really thought this variety of shows, I might do 6 or 10 of these 1-hour specials or something, and it's just taken on a life of its own. We keep on meeting people. But let's get back to your situation where you're a bunch of... bunch of long-haired hippies, basically, as they call it, and the paraquat getting sprayed. That's right after they started with this whole idea of calling it a war on drugs, Nixon's war on drugs. So you guys were realizing, like, you know, we should get more of this stuff, and you started to make connections into different countries. Is that how it worked? Did you had people in Mexico,
well,
I guess, and Colombia?
Basically, I think I went down to Jamaica for the first time, and it's where a lot of pot came from in the early days. Was out of Ocho Rios, up in the blue mountains of Jamaica. I first went down there on a lark, met a dude named Jesus. I should have known that was going to be a problem. And the dude took my money. and I never saw him again.
Well, maybe so that was his version of turning over the changing of the money tables, turning over the money changer tables.
Yeah, he was breaking the bread. That's right. Yeah. I never saw him again. But that didn't deter me. I got back to Miami, regrouped, and went back to Jamaica and met a good man down there, a good Rastaman, and started working, and things started happening, and the adventure took over, and we started getting really good sativa, Jamaican, ganja.
You were with how many people at the time, yourself, and who else was there starting at this level?
I usually had a couple of people that helped me, and then, of course, you have to hire. After a while, you do it yourself. I sailed down 3 or 4 times myself, and then I said, this is going somewhere. I need to expand, and instead of one boat, we'll get 2 or 3.
And what kind of boats were these? What size boat are we?
You get 4 or 5. We use mostly sailboats because they fit in well.
Sure.
Especially in the Caribbean, South Florida, the Bahamas.
Seen one, you've seen them all, right? Nothing strange to notice. They're all the same, and you have cover.
Nothing at all, just another pleasure craft.
Right.
So when you're smuggling, remember, you have to remember that word.
Pleasure craft.
Smuggling. So,
oh, sorry.
you're under the radar, dude.
And what kind of music were you listening to at that time? Do you remember?
Oh, geez, man. Reggae was just starting out.
Yeah.
Jimmy Cliff was just getting going. Peter Tosh. Of course, everybody listens to rock and roll. All the greats. Of course, they're all gone. Hendrix, the Stones.
Sure. Yeah.
A lot of blues music. I grew up on R&B. That's what I grew up on. So I loved all music. I mean, if you love music, you love it all.
Yeah. Did you play any kind of instrument at all?
No, I never played really. I love music and I know music, but I don't really play an instrument.
Okay,
that might be one of the things on my bucket list.
Well, I was just going to mention it because I've noticed lately in the past 15 months or so, I've been picking up piano, and I've been noticing that I'll do some rudimentary work and try to loosen up my fingers, and then I'll take a little hit. And I'll get a little bit in me, and it really takes you to a place of some concentration, and it seems to just almost instantaneously improve things, and it sort of like leaps and bounds a little bit at a time. I'm getting better at piano, and I think it has to do with unlocking certain restrictive aspects of the left hand versus the right hand. Anyway, I just wondered, because if anyone's listening, try a little hit and play your sax, play your clarinet, play your piano, play your guitar, see what happens. It's pretty cool.
Just play on, brother.
Play on, brother.
It does have an effect that it takes you to another level.
Yeah.
It takes you to a level that you wouldn't go to if you hadn't smoked, taken a hit or smoked part of a joint or taken a hit. It takes you to, it opens you up.
Yeah, while your pain's
going
on.
You hear notes you never heard before.
That's it, yeah.
And you can lay it down like you've never laid it down. And go,
exactly.
Where'd that come from?
Yeah, that's true. Now, I wouldn't want to perform like that because I don't think I could keep it together. But the creativity of that is unbelievable. It just seeps out. So,
and there's strains for that now. You want to be creative, you get your sativa strains out, man, and your creative juices flow. But I just had to throw that in, but go ahead.
No, that's okay. So now you're learning about all of this, and you're in Jamaica with your friends, and you're starting to fill these boats up. And how did it go the first time? Like, you must have been a little nervous the first time. You got a boat full of stuff, and you have to meet some heavy hitter who's going to give you a lot of money, or how did it work?
Well, it just starts off, slow. You work with a few people, and you make some money, and you end up going out on your own, I mean. It's just why I eventually found myself that I really didn't want to work for anybody else. I wanted to work for myself, and I could control things. I wouldn't say that I want to micromanage, but I was always better if I felt like I was in control and when other people are pulling the strings. So I eventually led to me doing my own thing and hiring my own crews and my own places to unload here in the States because, like I was thinking earlier, California hadn't come into play yet. So we were supplying the people that were in need for years before we are today in the cannabis business. We were the cannabis business.
When you say people in need, what do you mean by that specifically?
People knew they needed cannabis. They couldn't narrow it down like they do today, with how everything has gotten very strain specific. You know, like certain, you're talking about Charlotte's Web. You know, you're talking about certain illnesses and your own battle.
Right.
And what worked for you. Nobody really knew all those kind of things as a whole, but they just knew it. They felt good.
They felt better. Yeah, they just felt better.
Bad, if they weren't feeling good, they were feeling better.
Right.
When they smoked pot or they ingested somehow. They couldn't break it down like we do today.
Sure.
But they knew.
Yeah.
They knew. And so the demand was there, you know. We were meeting a need.
Right.
People were in need. Dudes are coming back from Vietnam. You talking about shell shock, and they're talking about PTSD today. Just, you know, check out and talk to some vets that came back from Vietnam. That was one hellhole.
Yeah.
So they came back during those times, early 70s, and they smoked pot, and it helped them. They didn't really know exactly what was going on, and it wasn't as widespread, of course, as it is today. But, you know, we created a need. And
that was only Vietnam. That's right. No, it was only Vietnam. Yeah. Now we're in Afghanistan. We're in Iraq. We're in Yemen. We're in Syria. We're all over the place.
We're all over the place.
Yeah.
And so I agree. We served a purpose, and people wanted it. People needed it. People asked us for it. When were we going again? Why didn't we have more? where could they get more?
So then you needed to get to a... So go ahead.
So there was a demand, and so and not only was it an adventure, and not only were we, you know, people were feeling good, and they knew it, and but we were kind of, you know, pressed into service, so to speak, to fulfill, you know, those needs and those wants from people. It reminded me somewhat of like Prohibition during when the booze was outlawed.
Right.
In the States. It's ridiculous, but everybody, I mean, so there was people smuggling booze back then, and it couldn't have happened, but there's smuggling going on today, but nothing like it was back in the day. That was a special time. That was, you know, the circumstances were all together, came together like a perfect storm. Vietnam, the counterculture, people thinking outside the box, anti-establishment.
Right.
Let's try something different. We're on, you know, and then so we were all part of that. You know, when you talk about music, you couldn't have music without the pot and the pot without the music,
yeah,
kind of thing.
So how many were you? How many folks of your group, like you and your friends, not just everybody smuggling in the world, but like you guys that were doing this thing, the gentlemen smugglers, as it's called, how many were you?
There were probably, you know, under that umbrella, I'd say 30.
And you all knew each other?
30. We all knew each other for the most part, yeah. And if we didn't, we knew somebody that knew somebody. You know, it was fairly close-knit. Usually when if it was time to go work and it was time to get on a sailboat, it was time to unload some pot, you ask your friends, or your friend ask a friend, you know, and it was usually fairly tight. So it wasn't a large group. Now over the years it grew some, but I would say 25 or 30 guys were the core group.
Yeah. So you must have had some after work barn burners, huh? A little blow off some steam, kind of have fun once in a while when you pulled off a successful import. Do you ever do that?
You know, we worked a lot. Of course it was a lot of partying, but it was a lot more work than it. You know, it may appear to the naked eye, but the parties, you know, we usually partied in the bigger cities. You know, we go to the Big Apple, we go to St. Bart's in the Caribbean. You know, we'd go to Bahamas, Miami, or we'd go fly to Europe for a while. You know, take a month or two off vacation, but then the phone would start to ring. You know, when are we going back to work, boss?
So you got to this place where you realized, listen, we need to bring in more stuff than we're bringing in. I mean, you can't just put a couple of couple of suitcases into a sailboat, and that's going to do it, right? You started had to increase the volume. What kinds of size of mount were you pulling in? Because this isn't cocaine or something heavily packed tightly. This is a very fluffy substance. It's a lot of bulk, right? So to get like a ton, that's a lot
bulky,
of space.
So the bigger the ship, the better. They used to when we shifted, my guys, we shifted from Jamaica and started going down to Colombia. Because the strain was better. They had Santa Marta gold, which is people call it Colombian gold today.
Oh, gosh.
A real good sativa.
Yeah.
It's really the grandparent of skunk.
Is it really?
All the skunks. Yes, it is.
Wow.
And so we started going to Colombia. So it's a little further trip from the East Coast, but so we got bigger boats. We got big fishing boats. We loaded 80-foot sailboats. There was also freighters. The Colombians like to send freighters up, and they'd have a couple of 100,000 pounds on board.
Oh my God!
Pounds on board. Yes, and then you would send your smaller boats out. It would take 100 boats to unload it. 80 boats. They'd send small boats, 20-footers, 30-footers. Everybody was surrounding the mothership off the Bahamas from time to time, then run back into Fort Lauderdale, Miami, or the Keys.
So I'm guessing go ahead.
It was the only source of pot for most of the country. Came in like that for years.
Yeah.
There was a lot of action. You would be bumping into people occasionally that you didn't even know doing the same thing you were doing.
Right.
It's getting busy down here in Florida.
So you guys were, when you were doing this and the amount of people, like you say, you're basically providing so much of the country with your imports. So what I'm going to ask you now is, this is getting into logistics to the point where, okay, so at the very beginning, of course, no one was suspicious of you because you hadn't done anything wrong before. You managed to get away with it. And then you're building this track record, this history of being able to do this. What kinds of thoughts or what kinds of precautions did you take? Like you're running boats in and out of international coastlines. How did you avoid any detection at all in the early stages?
Well, early on, you know, the government really wasn't aware of the magnitude of it. You only really worried in the early days about the Coast Guard. You know, our Coast Guard are normally white hull ships with a red diagonal stripe on them.
Yeah,
and so the only thing you worried about back then was if somebody was on watch and they went yipe stripes, you knew you may have a problem. But normally the Coast Guard was stretched very thin, so you know they confiscated very little in the early days for sure, maybe like 5% of everything that ever came this way. And they got a little bit better, and the United States Customs got involved, the DEA got involved some, the FBI, and so it became a bigger thing for the government in many ways to try to take people down, whether through their money, financially, what they were doing, or just, you know, catching them in the act. I know for 14 years they never caught us in the act. What brought us down in the end was conspiracy. I don't think they had a baggie full of weed.
Wow. The conspiracy, in other words, the planning that was required for you to be able to do these runs.
That's correct. The overt acts
is
what a conspiracy is made up from. I don't know if they have that in Canada or not, but we have conspiracy laws here that are used fairly on a regular basis for different types of crime. But, of course, we didn't consider it for a minute that we were doing anything that was illegal.
Right,
that's really pretty much been borne out for today, and where we're at today in the legal sense of where cannabis is today.
We don't have conspiracy here in Canada. There's no conspiracy here at all. I've been told this many times by lots of people that I'm crazy for even entertaining such a notion. So I guess it's just an American thing.
I don't know. We have it on our books. It's you know, you just have to have the overt acts. Well, he bought an airplane or he bought a boat.
Right,
and he paid such and such person, and he made a flight down to this country, and so they put all those acts together to come up with some bullshit to put you in prison. Like me, I did 11 years almost.
Oh, you're fast forwarding to the end. That's too bad. You did
well.
You
not,
did 11
not the
years.
End. I'm not. I'm not at the end. I'm just saying that we were talking about the government.
Right.
And how they, and what they do and the legality of it. You know, I saw where San Francisco may soon wipe out people's records that were convicted of pot.
Right.
Yeah, they're considering doing that, even felony convictions for pot.
So when you were finishing up a delivery, say you're getting cannabis and your marijuana, I guess they called it back then all the time, or weed or grass. So you're delivering that to whoever it is. Anybody watching movies or, you know, television shows, this is always a high stakes, high risk operation with guns. Were you guys prepared to kill or be killed, et cetera, or do we have a different take in reality?
Well, I just think you have to look at it as a whole. You know, that it wasn't a culture of violence, smoking pot. Just the act of smoking pot doesn't, you know, make me think, or anybody I've ever really been around, well, geez, I need to go in my closet and get my, you know, my Glock out. You know, it's time to go do some blasting. You know, when you smoke pot, the only thing you might blast would be the refrigerator. I mean... Yeah, I mean, for real, you're not, it just doesn't follow like cocaine that I can make you paranoid, anxious, you know, you're coming out of your skin, somebody's going to get you, let me get my piece and I hear them coming in the door kind of shit.
Right.
No, man, you know, if somebody was a knock on the door, you were stoned, like, yeah, come on in.
That's funny. So I
think pot didn't lend itself to being in violent, and to me and the guys we dealt with and the people I dealt with, which I dealt with millions of dollars. Somebody would take off 8 or 10,000 pounds of pot from me, and 2 or 3 or 4 months later, they'd bring me back $2 or $3 million.
Wow.
I never saw a gun. They never had a gun. They didn't use guns. I didn't use guns. For what?
Yeah.
We were selling pot, we were smuggling pot, and we were making money. Violence only brought on more heat.
Yeah. Well, I tend to believe the same thing. Yeah. So when you guys were starting to realize that okay, you've been eluding the Coast Guard every single time, whether you're going into you took your boats right into Colombia, so you're avoiding their Coast Guards, you're avoiding your own Coast Guards. How did you get a sense at some point, like, uh-oh, somebody knows something, the cops or whatever? How did that go down?
Well, I mean, you know, you can only get away with something like that for so long. You just hope to make as much money as you can, and then when the end comes, you're situated to deal with it in a positive sort of way, if you call going to prison positive. But it was, like I said earlier, the Coast Guard was spread thin. Sometimes we had a knowledge of where they were. Sometimes we knew where the people who patrolled those areas of water were. We knew what they drove. We had done surveillance on them a lot of times, so we were ahead of where they were.
Right.
They made me think they were watching us, but we were really watching them.
Sure. And you knew the game plan, so yeah.
We knew what they were doing, and we knew that, and we could also improvise. That was one of our greatest assets, was improv, you know, because none of this shit went down out of a book where you had rules that said, okay, on day one, this is what you do.
Right. It's just evolving.
On day two, this always evolving.
Yeah. I love the fact that it was nonviolent. It completely makes sense to me. You know, it's the whole mindset, like you said, the cocaine, nervous, twitchy, kind of jumpy angle, and heroin had this dark cloud over it and everything, but cannabis is, you know, it's a peace and love kind of thing. It's an awareness, relaxing, you know. It's just such a beneficial substance.
That's what I'm saying. It's got so many positive aspects to it, but it's like anything else. You can eat too much, drink too much. You know, you can do about everything you could ever think of doing it too much, and it's probably not good for you. But, you know, when you do a dosage or you do what helps you, then without going overboard, then that's where life really is, the balance.
Right.
And pot has a balance, and pot has great positive things. I mean, you take the Israelis. The Israelis are so far ahead of just about everybody in research. They've been doing it for years and years and years, and they've been allowed to do it, where, I don't know about Canada, but, you know, U.S.,
no,
it's hard for these universities to get research money when it's a Schedule I.
Yeah, it's an illegal drug, sure. And, yeah.
It's totally illegal, and it makes it hard to get research. And so people are dying probably right now. People are in pain right now probably because our government and the U.S. has not allowed enough research to go on and find more things, that more diseases and more of everything that pot would cure.
Well, that's absolutely the case. Yeah, absolutely. It definitely
and
is.
So it was always an uphill battle. Everything we were doing, we were just beating the government. You know, we were beating down the propaganda. We were part of that counterculture that what blossomed into where we are today in the cannabis business of sorts. And so, you know, you have to go back. You have to look at it in those terms. And I'm just glad it is where it is today. And I'm glad, that someone like you is kind of preaching the word.
Well, listen, you did 11 years in prison for this at the end of it. We'll get to that later because a lot of you, I think all of you guys went to jail at some point. But
yeah.
Isn't that true? Everybody in your gang got nailed?
Yeah, most everybody. Yeah, that's correct. Some more than others, but everybody did a little piece.
Yeah. So when you were living at that time, in those days, and you must have been hearing on the newspapers and on the radio, the constant talk about the war on drugs, Nixon's war on drugs, and we found out subsequently the nasty and nefarious and racist and control-based reasons they did that. But that must have been... that must have been something that, like, you must have had mixed feelings, because here's what I'm going to say. At the one time, you're doing all of that, but if it were instantly legalized, maybe you're not making that kind of money back then if it did turn over that quickly. So you literally were profiting from the, let's call it, regressive backward principles of the government.
Well, and people still are today, 40 years later. But to answer your question, that dilemma actually came up, you know, when Jimmy Carter ran for president, and he was there in the late 70s. It was actually, he had a platform to decriminalize marijuana for adults, totally, you know. And we were like, holy shit, this is great. We've worked for 5 or 6 years now. We've got some money. Now it could be legal, and everybody can enjoy without looking over their shoulders.
Yeah.
But of course, that fell apart for Jimmy for a few reasons. I think it was some internal problems with his son, who was involved in some things and his drug czar, Peter Bourne, were involved with some parties where some cocaine was and some other drugs, and it went downhill. So Jimmy Carter really never pushed it the envelope, and that all died out, of course, when our hero of all heroes, Ronnie Reagan, came into office, and he and Nancy said, "Just say no."
Well,
and that was that was the beginning of the end.
Yeah, just say no. Should have been just saying no to Reagan, but it was just say,
just say, right on, brother.
You know, it was he was an actor, huh? I mean, when did people start to? That's when I really realized, hey, these guys are actors. I mean, he was a famous movie star, but they're all actors. They're enacting. There's no democratic will here. When most people want to buy this stuff and want to get it, and they say it's a democracy, and then it isn't, because they punish people who use it. Still going on.
Yeah, and that's the terrible part. The two bad parts are you can go to jail still in a whole lot of places, and people are dying and in pain because of lack of research on a natural herb that was put on earth that man's been with for ever since we were here.
It's a lot of mind control, you know. They say things like,
"Sure,
you need this medication because it'll lower your inflammation in your knees and your joints and stuff like that. And you need this one to you know, get rid of your back pain. And you need this muscle relaxant to do this." And instead of just accepting the fact that this stuff targets the entire body, and they call it a crutch when you're using it to relax, to shake off your PTSD or work your way through it, to eliminate it, to improve your life, to take an edge off, as if this society doesn't give us enough reasons to be upset and panicky and anxious about things. And they call it a crutch. It's a crutch. It's a drug. You shouldn't be using it. It's a bad thing. And meanwhile, the pharmaceuticals that they tout are doing those same things, or trying to, and failing at it. You know, it's not a crutch to use an opioid for pain. It's fattening somebody's wallet, but it's a crutch if you take cannabis oil and use it for pain. You know, this whole double mindset that people aren't seeing is I can never get past it.
Well, it's part of the propaganda. It's part of big farms don't, big pharmacy pharmaceutical companies do not want their pot legalized right now. They're not in position yet. Of course, they're trying to position themselves because they know it's coming.
Yeah.
But they're not ready yet, so they lobby that. They come up with that bullshit. And if you take one of those pills that you just mentioned, or two or three or four, whatever you're taking them for, the side effects that you didn't mention are pages long. If you have this, now turn the page and pay of side effects that the pharmaceutical medication today is crazy. It's off the chain. Half the commercial on TV is about not what it'll do for you, but how it can hurt you.
Yeah.
So you go back to those days where Jimmy Carter came in and then Ronald Reagan came in with his wife, lovely Nancy, just say no. And he really ramped up the war on drugs. He threw the money at it. He said he was going to wipe pot off the map. You know, he was going to make it where there wouldn't be any more pot on the streets.
Another Republican lie. Oh, boy.
So that didn't happen.
No.
He tried, but it didn't happen. And eventually, he did have an effect on us because he threw everything at us. You know, the FBI, the IRS, U.S. Customs, DEA, you name it. Every agency you can think of.
So Reagan got in and they started to muck around in Grenada. What happened there? Were you guys involved in that?
Well, it was Grenada was a friend of mine was down there, as a matter of fact, named Bob the Boss, who was in the book, an adventurer, a sailor, smuggler, one of my partners. He's dead now. He happened to be down in Grenada when the Ronald Reagan sent in the Marines and the Navy and whatnot to take over Grenada because it had been the government had been overthrown by some so-called communists. And so my buddy was down there, Bob the Boss, on his boat, beautiful 75-foot custom sailboat, and he helped them get ashore. They didn't know what they were doing. Some of the Marines that came there, and he'd been there anchored up. He was staying there anchored up. It's a beautiful island. He just happened to be visiting when the war broke out and the Marines landed. So he helped them get around. He helped them figure out what to do, where to go, what roads to use. He actually worked with them for a day or two or three until they got control. I think one of them gave him a grenade launcher as a gift.
What?
Here, take this. You may need it one day on board. You never know if the pirates are going to board you one day in your your yachting world that you're in. So he actually got busted with it, I believe, when they finally took him down. He had the grenade launcher with him. But we were in the islands everywhere, Grenada. We were in St. Martin. We had a lot of our money was in offshore corporations. Like St. Martin has a Dutch side and a French side. The Dutch are very friendly back in the day for setting up offshore banking accounts because we didn't want our money in this country. They may find it. They may run it down. We had money in Liechtenstein. We had money in the Channel Islands over in Jersey, England. We had money in France. Money buried. We had money everywhere.
Money everywhere. That sounds so American.
It is. It was. It was totally American.
That's so cool. Totally. Listen, we're going to take a break for just a little second. We do have the wonderful Barry Foy on the phone. You might know him as Flash. You might know him as one of the guys who got involved in bringing cannabis into the country in the first place. Right on. But right now, I have to do a little throw out here for Truth Seeker app. Truth Seeker is for discerning news junkies. So let's say you want to listen to this show or Conspiracy Queries or perhaps Scott Horton or Red Ice Radio or Skepticality or Rune Soup or Media Monarchy or The Jimmy Dore Show and so many more. You want to get on Truth Seeker app. It's an app for your Android. It's an app for your iPhone. We're happy to be on there. It's a great little app. You maybe you only need one app on your phone, and if you do, for your news and your information, Maybe you want to get it from Truth Seeker app. Download that right away. Well, just wait till the end of the show and then download it. Okay, we're back now with Barry. Barry's on the line still from Charleston. Charleston. So, so Reagan's in there. Now, listen, did any of you guys ever get skin cancer? I figure you're in the sun all the time.
Well, you know, I'm sure that somewhere on this old ragged-ass body of mine, I've got some skin cancer. Yeah, have you got a cure for me?
I do, actually. Well, here again, it's not necessarily a cure so much as changing your body. But, yeah, you can use cannabis oil on these horrible right. situations. Not smoking a joint isn't going to do anything. But if you use the oil, both internally and topically, check that out. I was just thinking of all you guys on the boats back then, and there wasn't sunscreen, and maybe sunscreen's not a great idea, but you guys were in the sun all the time. I'll bet you were all looking like a bunch of leather bags.
Yeah, just like old lizards. That's why I need that warm sun in a rock, you know, in the morning. When I drink my coffee, I got to be laying on a rock.
Well, I hope that's what you get to do. Are you still in touch with some of the guys? Too.
Oh yeah, we're together quite a bit. We actually get together. We used to get together once a year. It's kind of died off now because some of the people have passed. But we used to have what they call the Felons Ball.
Okay.
And a friend of mine, one of the guys, and he had a big spread, nice house, and so we'd get together, the 15 or 20 of us. That had been in prison. We were all basically out, and we started having the felon ball once a year so we could all get back together and reminisce and, socialize and catch up with each other.
That's good. Well, I'm glad because those guys aren't still in jail, right? Like, you're all out of jail now.
Yeah, no, everybody's out. Everybody's been out for years.
Okay.
So you have to keep it in the timeline. I think the most anybody did was about 16, 17 years.
I'm going to read a chunk from the book here and just get you to comment on it. The preferred method of boarding a ship for customs officers was to approach a vessel slowly, announcing U.S. Customs with their bullhorn as they surveyed the scene. Then they would say, "How many men are on board?" They'd ask that through the bullhorn. "Do you have any weapons?" And so on. After that, the patrol boat would pull alongside, asking for cooperation as they tied off to the other boat and secured fenders. Two customs agents could board, while a third customs officer kept at the wheel of the law enforcement vehicle. Tonight, Bell and Jefferson couldn't count on cooperation. In light of the sailboat heading to sea, the boarding could not be a protracted by-the-book affair. The only choice was to ram and board the sailboat, they decided, with Jefferson as the sole boarding officer. Jefferson readied for a full assault boarding, weapon drawn. He held a Smith & Wesson .357 revolver, a veritable cannon capable of instantly dropping a man. It was one of the few weapons the Marine officer said he could count on not to be corroded by salt. Strapped to his body were speed loaders and at least five pairs of handcuffs. So that's not any kind of fun, hey, when a guy like that gets on your boat?
No, I think I believe I know what the story you're talking about that particular night. No, it's not. And they got lucky that night. That was a boat that was full of hash from Lebanon. It had sailed all the way from Lebanon through the Med, across the Atlantic, and had come there that night to unload. And they just happened to be one of those nights, and I believe it was in the early 80s when they started doing patrols on certain waterways and happened to see a suspicious boat with no lights on. Normally, if a boat's underway or anchored up, there's a light either on the top of the mast or there's running lights, starboard and port. But this particular sailboat had no lights that night, and they saw it off in the distance at night. I guess they had night vision glasses and spotted it, and that started that cascading downhill. And everybody, they busted about 15 people on that deal and 15,000 pounds of hash.
So did you ever make that sail from and to Lebanon? I mean, that's a long ride, isn't
No, that is an extremely long ride.
Was that like 3 weeks or something?
Very dangerous. A lot can happen in that trip. At least 3 weeks, sometimes more than a month, depending on if you had any problems, you broke a mast, had engine problems, ran out of food or water. A lot of things can happen.
Yeah.
On that type of, anytime you're on the water, anything can happen.
Sure.
It's you against Mother Nature.
Yeah.
So that was part of the adventure. That was part of sailing down and loading a boat and coming back. And
so that's the kind of problem. Go ahead.
Taking that risk, taking that chance. That's adventure.
So that's the kind of thing that can happen on the high seas, right? Where you, all those things, you can take on water, all this kind of stuff. But as far as legalities are concerned, when you're in the middle of the ocean, it's probably nothing, right? You're more concerned about approaching the coastline when the authorities are involved.
Well, exactly. There's nobody out there. There's a big ocean out there, as they say. No, you always tighten up when you could see land or you know you were close, because that's where the danger was. It wasn't out in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
Not from any law enforcement.
Right, so you're dealing with the elements in the middle of the water, and then you're dealing with maybe the police and the Coast Guard, et cetera, when you get close. So it's always a bit of a high stress.
It was very stressful the entire time, but it paid well, and you had plenty of people standing in line that were ready to go. There was never a shortage of people wanting to experience the thrill, to experience that successful operation, so to speak, that Jesus, man, look what I've done. I brought back a boatload of Colombian gold. God, just look at it and you see it all. And when you were down there, it's all part of a successful mission of sort. You know, we beat them again.
So how much weight on a ship, like a large run from Lebanon? This is Les Riley organizing this, is that right?
Yeah, Les organized a lot of those. That there could be as much as 30,000 pounds of hash.
Okay, so that's 15 tons or so, close to that?
That's 15 tons, yeah.
So if you have 15 tons of cannabis on a boat, or let's say you've got a small, whenever you guys were doing the briefcases, the suitcases in the early days, but when you have that much weed, how do you deal with the smell? I mean, isn't it when you pull into the harbor, everybody could smell it, or did you plastic contain it, or how did you keep it all segregated so it wasn't so obvious?
Well, it really wasn't segregated. You piled it in, and you hoped you had a little space left to in the galley to get down and maybe make yourself something to eat on a hot plate and get something cold out of the fridge if that was all possible, and you were sleeping on top of bales. Mm. It was a lot of time. If another boat would come up on you, it would be immediately recognizable as a boat full of weed. It was just everywhere. Sometimes you just pack it to the gills, because why leave one bale behind?
I think I was born in the wrong time. I really do. I think I was supposed to be down there with you guys. I think I was supposed to be 20 years older, and I should have been down there.
I think you were in spirit.
I think so too.
I mean, I think you were in spirit. So there was a lot of high seas drama.
Yeah,
it took a lot to pull off operations. It took a lot of luck. It took preparation, and it took people on this end that were willing to take the chance too and get out there and hustle it and find buyers. We didn't have dispensaries back then.
No,
you had to make it for yourself, and so it took a large group of people on both ends. I mean, pot we brought in and hash we brought in went New York, Boston, Chicago, Memphis, Dallas, Texas.
That was all your weed. Hmm.
DC, you name it, it was there. Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. We had people in all those cities.
Okay, so you weren't doing all of that yourself. You were bringing it in. So those people doing that, there are PTSD Vietnam survivors helping you out with this. Is that right?
Yeah, we had people that would come back from Vietnam because they were trustworthy, as well as they had been in combat and were used to, high-stress situations. And we used... quite a few guys I know that came back from Vietnam that worked in this business, smuggling pot. They did a good job. They liked what they were doing. They were naturals.
And I guess that was shell shock back then, that they were not PTSD per se, but they were messed up from going to Vietnam. So they got to use some of the product, and they found that took the edge off while they were doing their job of proliferating.
Of course, and all it was a web of folks to make it all happen and make it successful and come to fruition, which would be in the end that you collected your money for what you were put through to make this happen. I mean, It's very easy today. It was very difficult back in my time to bring this product to the people.
Yeah.
And bring them joy. Foy brings you joy is what I used to tell folks.
Yeah. Did you ever get into conversations with people down there? Like, and what I mean is this. So you knew what you were doing, and you knew that you liked it, and you knew what was enjoyable and profitable about it, and you knew the quality of the product. You knew everything you needed to know. So when you were maybe at a bar or having a restaurant meal somewhere or just mixing with someone in the public, did you ever run across somebody who, you know, was government mind control to the point, well, this is terrible stuff, and just have like a conversation with them about, no, listen, it does bring benefit in anything, and you had to deal with mind-controlled compatriots, other Americans who just couldn't believe this stuff, and you've got that sort of that war set up. It's bad, it's bad. No, it's good. And it's perpetuated like that. Did you ever have those conversations?
I think you find that today. So you know you found it back then, and I'm sure I had that conversation exactly how you described it. There was always someone who was a doubter.
Yeah.
There was always someone who couldn't get beyond the propaganda and couldn't get beyond what the government had preached and put out there for people to suck up and be dumbified by. It's incredible how hard the government's tried to keep all this down. And we're still dealing with it today with the current administration here in the States. And so y'all are lucky in Canada. You've got a good prime minister. He makes sense, and or at least he's trying to make sense of it.
Yeah. Well, let's not get into an argument. I'm having such a great time with you right now. I don't really want to talk about Justin Trudeau.
No, I know. We won't go there.
That's okay. All right. I could tell you another time. He's I get it. He looks good from a distance, but when you really start picking it apart, you realize it's not that great of a thing.
Yeah.
That's incredible to me that you were doing so well for that amount of time, and that these magic spells where people think it's such a terrible thing because their government told them. It's amazing to me that it still has hold over anyone. But let's bridge the gap a little bit. This has been so great talking with you, by the way. Thanks for giving up your time this afternoon.
My pleasure.
I want to learn a little bit more about, let's bridge the gap. So you guys are out there, cowboys, you're bringing it in, you're having fun, you're making money, you're getting it done, you're providing people with pain relief, etc. And it's going really well. But now some things have started to fall apart and or go wrong, probably because of investigations from your governmental opposition. And how did that unfold? Like, how did that just begin to be the whole sinking ship and then everybody had to go to jail? Let's get through that part.
Well, you know, like I said, when Ronnie Reagan came in, it really accelerated from the government's side as far as how they were approaching us and approaching, you know, people that were smuggling. They kind of started with the financial end. They had a few tips from the rats that were out there. It was always an informant. You never could, you know, somebody was always going to be weak. The government intimidated a lot of people with long sentences, and sometimes people would give the government information to get a lighter sentence. And a little tip here and a little tip there, they started open up a can, you know, and found some real estate transactions. They found some corporate papers. They started to find a paper trail.
Right.
Into our finances. And once they started getting into our finances, they were able to expand from there and to take more people down and eventually break us all up, make us all basically scatter, indicted us. Tried to arrest us all and did arrest a lot of people and eventually everybody in the end. But it started with a paper trail. It started with the IRS, really.
Oh, yeah.
Breaking us down and finding, follow the money.
Yeah. So before you got to that part, were you buying Cadillacs and you know, Corvettes and racing cars?
Oh,
and
sure.
All that stuff?
Sure. Sure. I remember buying my first Porsche in 1974 in Atlanta, Georgia. I walked in with a paper bag with $15,000 in it. At that time, the dealer in Atlanta was kind of in the hood. It was on the edge of the hood, even though it was downtown Atlanta in those days. And when I walked in, I said, I like that one on the showroom. It was red Targa. I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
Beautiful car. And he said, you'll take that one. And I was had flip-flops on and shorts and a T-shirt and a paper bag. And he looked at me like, you're not, dude, you really ain't going to be able to buy this car for real.
Yeah.
I said, yeah. He said, how are you paying for it? And I said, cash. I said, right here in this bag. And he said, oh, my God. He said, come in my office, because he was kind of worried because there I was with cash, and we were in a kind of a questionable neighborhood. Ran inside his office. He closed the blinds and counted the money, and I drove out in that red Porsche. Yes, sir. First car.
So that's amazing.
I started out and I love cars, and I bought quite a few of them, and everybody did. Everybody spent their money. They might as well. I mean, you can't take it with you.
Sure, you got tons left, and you're but you got to buy something, right? I mean,
there was Ferraris and Porsches and Mercedes and BMWs, and we had all that stuff, fur coats.
Yeah,
just the crazy stuff you do when you're young, and you're young and in your 20s, and you're millionaires.
And you're bringing in tons of hash from Lebanon on ocean liners. Yeah, sure. You know, the typical sort of American Norman Rockwell.
So, yeah, we spent it like we made it. We really did. I mean, we always went first class, and why not? I mean, but I'll tell you, we also were underground as much as you could be. And so, like, for instance, when I would fly on a commercial flight somewhere, you always sit next to someone, and then inevitably you'd strike up a conversation and, well, what do you do? You know, you might be asked. And I always had a real estate. I had a real estate card with me that had a false name on it, you know, and it had real estate entrepreneur and New York City, just some bullshit on there, you know. And
yeah,
so it wasn't like we flaunted everywhere. You couldn't just tell the guy next to you on the airplane, yeah, I'm a pot smuggler, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So there was concealment. There, you know, we kept it underground, but at times it was hard not to be a little bit out front.
Yeah.
And I used to fly the Concorde when it flew.
That you flew the Concorde? Travel. Oh, God. I definitely needed
to fly
the
Concorde. We were going to Europe. I mean, we went to Europe a couple of times a year. You know, we spent a month or two over somewhere in France. So we lived well, and we deserved it.
Sure.
And we knew what it was like to make money, but we also knew what people liked and what they needed. And people still need good cannabis today. They always will.
That's for sure. So this is the fascinating thing in the book, and people might not understand this until you take a look at a map, and a relatively local map, is that your prime source of import was originally South Carolina, but you also spread it up and down from Florida right on up to Maine. Isn't that right?
Right. We were Florida to Maine, all the way up down the East Coast, wherever you could feel comfortable in. Because once you know the water like we did, once you know boats, and it's easy to go assimilate yourself into a little community where there might be a very nice-looking place with deep water. It's very quiet. It's secluded. That's what we look for. Remember, we were smugglers.
Now, how did you find that? You found that from the land side of things, or you must have already known where you were pulling in?
It was local knowledge. Also, just, you know, surveying it yourself, doing your homework, knowing the layout of the land, knowing that part of the world where you were, like Maine. It's like Nova Scotia and up into Canada. It's very rocky and very tricky. It's very rough and unpredictable. Virginia is a lot like South Carolina. Florida's flat, fairly easy.
Yeah.
And we smuggled on the West Coast too. We also smuggled into Seattle, Washington. That was probably the last deal I ever did.
Wow.
We came from Thailand.
So folks may realize that when you look at the line between, say, the Florida, wherever you might want to put port there, on up to Maine, and you look at that on a map, that's let's say that's 6 inches long. If you're looking at it in a book, you got a 6-inch long line between Florida
coastline
and Maine. You've got a 6-inch coastline in a book. But what that's not really the case, though, because if you zoomed in on it and you unbent the wavy, the curvy lines that make up the shoreline, that thing is so long. You've got an unbelievably long, so you're scoping it out from land. Oh, we can put it into this cove, and we can put it into this town, and there's so much more. It's not just like Boston, Philadelphia, New York, you're done. It's like all these inlets.
No, you microed it out. You know, you picked one little secluded spot, and that's why we did so well in South Carolina. It's a very unpopulated coastline,
right?
And if you knew the locals, you knew the people who fished here all their lives, who caught shrimp here all their lives, people who own shrimp boats. We used a lot of shrimp boats. You know, we utilized what was here, and so. I think having knowledge of the ocean and having knowledge of what we took, everything we mostly did was by boat.
Yeah.
Now, you had a lot of smugglers that used airplanes, but we didn't. We never used planes. We weren't in the plane business.
Right.
We were in the boat business. And so.
Well, you're still alive. You got Barry Seal going in and out of Arkansas is no longer alive. So, you know, you probably made the right choice.
Yeah. Yeah, he met his demise. But the government was involved in pot smuggling as well.
Yeah.
And
how does that work exactly? What does that work? How is the government involved? Tell me about that.
If you're Oliver North, you know, you'd know how to take care of all that. You know, the government's giving you okay to land at an Air Force base. The government's giving you an Air Force plane. All that Iran-Contra stuff was underground and supplied.
Yeah.
By drugs. That war was paid for by drugs.
And bringing back heroin and cocaine, I heard, but I think heroin from Vietnam, inside body bags and even sometimes inside body parts? This is what I heard back in
the day. Right. Well, that was the government was probably involved in some of that as well.
Yeah, Air America.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, there you go. And so it only comes out in dribbles and bits. Who knows how really big it was.
Yeah.
You know, when you land at Air Force Base, nobody really knows. So that went on some, but we didn't really bother ourselves too much. We were busy doing what we knew how to do best.
Now, I know you've been up here before in Canada. I realize that because there was a time when you were hiding in Quebec so that you didn't get in trouble from the federales down in the United States. Is that right? You were in Quebec for a while?
I was actually in Montreal.
Montreal. Okay. Well, we have a question here up on the thread. It says, does Barry have anything to do with all the hash that was in Montreal in the 70s? If so, I would like to thank him. So... I remember as a kid, a high school kid in Toronto, we always had weed and stuff, but it was always coming from Montreal and Montreal, the hashish, it was always coming from Montreal all the time.
We were late 70s, and the Canadians always had hashish, and more so than Americans. Americans seem to be more pot-oriented and still are today, but I was in Montreal at one time. And actually crossed the border and had a foot chase there at the border of Canada and going into New York at a customs station. It's in the book. It's kind of a crazy chase scene. It's probably going to be in an upcoming TV series soon.
Let's talk about that for a second. Yeah, this is we've got a TV series featuring you fellas now. Can you tell us a little bit about that without jumping the gun? Can you tell us kind of what's the scope of the show?
Well, without jumping too far ahead, it's in the works. There's a Canadian group that's very interested and has bought the life rights to some of the players that are involved and have started doing some interviews. And I think they have the concept that we want to do a TV series out of it, which is very exciting. We've been trying to do this for some years now, since the book came out. The entertainment business is a difficult one. I don't probably have to tell you.
No.
And so it's taken a while to meet the right people. But my new motto, and I've always felt this way, I just haven't expressed it, is I love Canadians.
Well, that's good. I like a lot of them. I do. I like a lot of great.
So
many
these
of them.
these guys that are interested now, are very, very interested. They're very determined. I believe they're going to be able to pull it off, and we're down with them 100%.
That sounds great. I don't know what you're going to talk about or how it's going to be, but I'm sure that would be tipping your hand, and let's not do that. But it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. You'll have to come on again when it's going to launch, and we'll talk to you some more.
I'd love to do that, and I'm sure that they would like that as well, let the people know what's going to be out there for them to watch.
So some of the things that were interesting in the book and in your story, and it's pointed out many times, and we've already talked about your relatively calm and relaxed ethos of running this stuff. You weren't a bunch of crazy machine-gunning lunatics. Is that the feds or the folks, the cops involved in taking you down, if you will, were quite, what would you say, respectful or relieved that they knew that you guys weren't violent, and that some of them look back now on that time of chasing you down and arresting you with a lot of fondness as far as policing goes? Did you ever meet some of these guys and talk about that after the fact? Or?
You know, there's still one or two of them around that I've seen them around. I haven't really spoken to them, but I've seen what they've said, and they've generally expressed that they respected what we were doing. I mean, they knew what we were doing was, it was on a large scale. It took a lot of planning. It took a lot of brains. And I think that they respected that, even though, you know, they were doing their job, which at times was dirty. Some of those DEA cops were dirty. And I'm not going to mention any names, but, but for the most part, the guys in the end, a lot of times they went to the same schools that the guys they were prosecuting went to.
Yeah.
And so they knew each other. They knew one another. They were in the same fraternities in college. They knew people's families, knew each other. The prosecutors knew the defendants' families and stuff. So it wasn't like they were running after, somebody that was, getting ready to do something crazy and violent and extreme. We were, when it turned out, we were just, we were on an adventure that was something good for people.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they realize it from a cannabis standpoint now, but they realize from a respect standpoint and the logistics of the operation that, that we have a respect as business people almost.
Yeah. Well, maybe
what we pulled off. I mean, remember, they couldn't catch us.
Right. So now you have.
It was like the Dukes of Hazzard sometimes, man.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to. Yeah. So hopefully there will be some of that in your TV show, because I'm sure there's a lot of good stuff.
No doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt.
So you live in South Carolina still. That's your main residence, South Carolina?
Yeah, it is. I've lived all over the world of. Pretty much, but I've lived in South Carolina for the last 20 years, ever since I got out of prison.
So your Henry McMaster is your current governor, Henry McMaster. Tell us about him and what you know about
him. Henry was one of those prosecutors that knew and was friends and in the fraternity with several of the people that he ended up helping put in jail. The only thing Henry ever won in his life was a lieutenant governor he ran for a couple of years ago, and he didn't run against anybody. He'd always lost every election he'd ever run for. I don't think he's like the smartest guy in the world, but he won the lieutenant governor, and then when he came and supported Trump here in South Carolina and came out on the bandwagon for Donald, Donald did him a favor, and the only way Donald could do him a favor was to take the governor we had, Nikki Haley, who is now the UN ambassador now, and that left the space open as lieutenant governor. He moved into the governorship.
Okay.
And so Trump did him that favor because Nikki Haley had come out against Donald Trump. She didn't really like him.
Right.
And said so, but to do because Trump and McMaster are kind of alike. So that ought to tell you something.
Sure.
Without me going into detail.
No, I get it. And he was nominated by President Reagan as United States Attorney for District.
Yeah, that's right.
So he's got that kind of history going on. So before we get to the end.
He's a Reagan.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
He's a Reagan.
No, he's a Reagan man. You're right. Yeah. Reaganite.
Tons of fun. So before we have to get going soon, but this is so terrible because I could just talk to you all day. This is fantastic. But let's talk a little bit about, you know, in your own, you got 30 guys in your little clique. They all got nailed at some point. The whole thing fell apart. The feds moved in on you. They had all the banking records, the paper trail, as you say, for them turned into fruition of arresting all you guys. What were you charged with?
They have a statute. And it's called 848. It's called Continual Criminal Enterprise, CCE. It carries 10 to life. And so that's what they had me under, the Kingpin statute.
Wow.
As well as two or three other people that I was involved with that were part of the organization. So that was the statute. It carried 10 to life. And it really wasn't meant for pot smugglers, I don't think. Really, they had actually brought that back in the 70s to fight the mob and take them down, but they ended up using it, and they could seize your assets without a conviction.
Oh, I see.
Forfeiture seizures. They would come take everything that they could find without having yet arrested you. They could, if that was your boat, they would take it. If they could find your money, they would take it without a conviction, without an arrest.
Right.
Those are some of the, that's how that went down.
Okay. And then, so you were found guilty and you were sentenced to how long?
I was sentenced to 18 years.
18 years.
So on the 18 years, I ended up doing 11 years. Right.
11 years. And did you pay for your lawyer with the money that you were able to squirrel away from the feds?
I had money for attorneys, but, that attorneys weren't going to do me any good unless they could come up with some kind of something that nobody had ever heard of.
Right.
When the feds get you after hunting you for 4 or 5 years, they have so much on you that you're going down.
Yeah.
You know, they're very, when they get you, you're done. You know, you're not going to beat it. The feds have about a 96 or 97% conviction ratio.
Okay, so tell me this. You're in jail, you've been doing time for a little while, and you know, boy, oh boy, you got a hell of a lot more time to do. Did you have any measure of respect for yourself in the prison from the other guys because of what you were doing, or did you have a tough time in there?
No, I mean, I think I had one run-in the whole time I was there. I mean, you know, it's all how you carry yourself in prison. I mean, I didn't let anybody, you know, disrespect me, and that's the main thing in prison. And I kept to myself a lot.
Right.
You know, I struck up partnerships, so to speak, with some of the guys, some Gambino folks out of New York, and I structured myself with the right people in prison, and stayed to myself. So I never had a problem, and I probably got a little respect for who I was. I mean, I didn't flaunt it and whatnot, but people find out who you are, sure. Yeah.
And at some point, did you think, gee whiz, I wish I didn't do all that stuff. Now I'm in jail. God, did you never thought that?
No.
Why not?
No, because I knew what I'd done wasn't really anything wrong. I didn't go out and hit somebody over the head and take their money. I didn't go beat somebody up or, you know, shoot somebody and rob them or I didn't go steal anything. I didn't take anything. People begged me to, you know, or wanted more. When am I going to get more? It was no forcible act that we were into. And so, hell no, I would do it all again tomorrow.
Well, however gently you'd like to color all of that, I still am nothing but grateful for your, let's call you a pioneer, let's call you a smuggler, that's what you were doing, but I love that you were doing it, and I love that your folks, your fellows on your team were able to import that, create an awareness, I'm sorry it took 30, 40 years for us to kind of even get close to turning things around, but you guys made a great sacrifice, and I am so thrilled to be able to speak with you live in person. Well, not almost in person, but you know what I mean. I'm very thrilled to be able to say thank you for doing it. You might have taken those 11 years as no big deal, and you worked your way through it, but to me, it's you know, it's like just about almost a fifth or a quarter of my life. So I have my life because I was able to get into this stuff, and it's guys like you that kick the damn door open. So my hat's off to you, and I'd like to express great good luck and good fortune on your new show. Tell me some other stuff you've been doing since you got out of jail, which was, when was that, and what have you been doing other than just building up this TV show, etc.? What are you up to now?
I got out in prison in 1995 and pretty much went back into what I had known before and what I had invested a lot of my money in that I had made over those years smuggling, which was real estate.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you opened up a Porsche dealership. And sold
a
lot of
Targas. That would have been cool, too. I would have loved to have done that. Believe me, I'm still a fan.
Yeah.
But then I kind of combined the real estate business and the construction business together. And I've been in those two fields for the last 20 or so years. I've been in the restaurant business occasionally, you know.
Yeah.
And but that's a young man's game. I'm 67 now, so I'm kind of on the downslope. I'm easing out of all that. I'm trying to spend some time. I got a couple of young kids still. I started a second family, and I've got a 10-year-old and a 16-year-old daughter.
Fantastic.
So I try to spend as much time as I can with them, and while the day's away, and go out to California and see what they're doing. I've got some investments in California in the business out there, in the cannabis business.
Yeah.
And so I pay attention to that, and I'm involved with that somewhat. And there's a group out there that my buddies in California work with, Weed for Warriors Project.
Weed for Warriors, okay.
Weed for Warriors Project. You can find them at Weed for Warriors Project at WFW_project.
Okay, thanks. We're going to look you up there. We also have Green Veterans here in Canada. Once again, the book is Jackpot, High Times, High Seas, and the Sting That Launched the War on Drugs by Jason Ryan. We've got all of these great stories from Barry in here and more and the other guys. It's a really fun read, and I'm saying that as a person that hasn't read it, but I've read about it, and I've read the beginning and the close. I just got the book yesterday. We didn't know you were going to be on. Thank you so much for coming on, and good luck in all your future ventures. I hope I get to see you in your own backyard sometime. They usually only say this to the military, but I'm going to say this to you. Thank you for your service.
Well, Alan, it was a pleasure. I'm a fan of yours now. I've already watched quite a few of your interviews. I think you're really, really good at what you do, man. So keep up the good work, and I'll be following you. And if you're ever down this way, please stop in, and I hope to be talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much. I'm hoping to take you up on that. We will definitely have you back on at the very, very least. Thank you, Barry.
Smoke him if you got him, brother.
Smoke him if you got him. Okay, thanks a lot. That was Barry Foy, also known as Flash. That's kind of weird. I know another guy, Flash, in my life. He's got nowhere near the brain power of this gentleman right here. So not always do you get the name Flash, and does it make sense? Hey, so we're getting close to the end of the show now. This is kind of long. We've got a couple of minutes left to go, but I still have to speak with somebody else. And that particular person is awaiting my call. So let's go to that right now. And it's hopefully, I'm not going to tell you who it is until we get him on. Okay, here we go. God, that thing's loud. Hey, this show's live, and I'm kind of operating it by myself, so I'm sorry about any kind of volume glitches and hitches that might happen along the way. We are calling this gentleman. I wonder if he's going to be able to answer. And it seems like... Yeah, or it seems like... Nope. Are you there? Oh, you're there. Hey, Paul. How's it going? Paul Hartman, ladies and gentlemen, guest from a few episodes ago. How are you today?
I'm excellent. How are you, Alan?
I'm excellent, too. Did you get to hear me speak with our friend from South Carolina?
Absolutely. I listened to the whole show intently.
What would you have asked? We weren't able to do a crosshatch. I wanted to bring you in on it because you have an incredible background experience as well. We've only got a couple of minutes. I'm so sorry, but I was enraptured by the man. But what would you have asked him if you got the chance?
If he knew Mark McIntyre would be one of them, who was a huge smuggler from Colombia. And it was from Colorado and, someone I knew well, but, yeah, so many things in common, you know, that whole time period, on the West Coast was, and I think the timeline for California started earlier because surfers who were going surfing in Mexico brought in the first marijuana, other than what Mexicans brought in. And that was early, you know, in the '60s and early '70s.
You mean a backpack on their surfboard or something, or how did they do that?
Oh, all kinds of ways. Like my first smuggle I did when I was 19, I carried 100 pounds, 8 miles into Bisbee, Arizona. Right. And people were stuffing panels in cars and, you know, going down and surfing in Baja and then crossing the border that way with the wheel well stuffed full of pressed cannabis, you know?
Yeah.
So, and then people started doing airplanes or making all kinds of modified vehicles. The first stuff I did other than the backpacking thing were ground vehicles where we would take fifth wheel trailers and we'd shorten the interior by 2 feet and put an extra step in over the bed that went over the truck. And we'd have to press the stuff really hard, but we'd get 2000 pounds in it. You know,
how did you press it exactly? What did you have, a compression unit?
Yeah. We'd take trash compactors down there and we would use trash compactor bags and we'd place the stuff in. And just crank it down, you know, and it wasn't pretty, but at that time, you know, weed was seeded and you had to go through a lot of it to find the very best stuff. And a lot got damaged in transport. You know, you can fill a boat full of weed and it sits on the bottom of a boat bouncing around in the sea for a month. And it's not the way it was when you packed it, you know, right. When it gets there, you know, and if it was coming from Thailand, you know, they packed that stuff in Thailand green and it would get here and it would be gold or it'd be moldy. Right. And, you know, so there it was one of those kind of deals where getting it to that point where quality was what it was about were the kind of things I did. Right. I did my smuggling and then I became, because I could communicate well with the people who were growing it and knew what it was the problems were that they had to solve. And I would teach them how to do that. And that was when the seedless really started to happen more consistently. And then the nature of how we packed it became more refined. And for me, like, I couldn't wait for a boat. That was too much stress. It took too frickin' long. Right. Same thing with the ground thing. You got to drive 2,200 miles with a loaded vehicle with a family in it, you know, so that it only hits the border. It looks right when they're trying to cross, right?
Yeah.
And I went into airplanes. Airplanes were what I loved because you knew in a few hours, right? and the stress was off and planes are a lot of fun.
So what you're saying is that Barry was running things on dial-up and you wanted to go high-speed internet with your smuggling.
You know what Barry did was, here's the thing about boats, and I did one trip in the Caribbean on a boat and we hit a storm here's the thing about sailing is 50% ecstasy and 50% complete fucking terror. Right? And he knows it and he will go, he's nodding his head. I can guarantee you now, because he's done some of those long runs and you just don't know what's going to happen. And the weather in the Caribbean changes so fast. And we bought a boat in Costa Rica. We went down through the Panama Canal and we went to Colombia. and we picked up 125 pounds of hash oil.
Wow.
And we strapped it to the deck in butane tanks that looked like the tanks we used on the boat. And so we're coming up, and if you look at a map of the Yucatan Peninsula in Cuba, you see that they're not very far apart in nautical miles. It's a very narrow stretch, and you want to hit the center of that because you want to stay away from Belize and those areas where at the time they had Belizean pirates and shit like that you had to deal with. And we got into a storm where the wind was blowing straight down, and we were on a 40-foot trimaran, and you know, when the wind comes and it hits the water and it gets under the wings of a trimaran and the amas on the outside are flapping like a seagull's wings.
Right.
And all you can hear is, holy shit, the boat's going to break up any second. And the two guys you're with are so freaked out that they inflate the life raft in the cabin of the boat. You know, something's fucked up. And then, you know, it was an 18-hour long storm. And the next day we're sitting there like, holy shit, the boat is just beat to hell. We had stanchions that ripped out of the deck and all kinds of shit. And and the next thing we know, we hear this explosion and this thing zing by us and splash in the water next to us. And we're like, the fuck was that? And we see a Cuban gunboat barreling down on us.
Oh, wow.
And we get boarded, and I was a Canadian. I had a Canadian passport, and the other two guys were American. And we had blown into Cuban waters, and they took us in. They left me on the boat.
Because you were Canadian?
Yeah, and they took those other guys away for a week. And I'm like, I didn't know what was going on. I'd run out of food. I was like, I couldn't leave the boat. They found a shotgun. They tried to accuse us of running guns. And they never looked at the 125 pounds of oil that was sitting on the deck in the butane tanks.
Unreal.
And they eventually let us go. And we went into New Orleans and parked the boat in a little bayou and walked away from the thing and never saw it again.
Well, Paul, you know, we could just sit here and talk for 2 hours, just you and myself here. So we're not going to do that. We're at the back end of a crazy long show. I hope you enjoyed it. But I want to tell folks a couple of things. Number one, Paul is going to be on the show again in a couple of weeks, live in the studio here with us. I think it's April 10th or something. I'm not sure. And
it is April 10th indeed.
Yeah. So what's going on with you in the meantime? I understand you're going to be speaking at the Windsor, Ontario, which is actually north of Detroit, folks, if you're American listeners, a little piece of Canada. Sorry, it's actually south of Detroit. Detroit is north of Windsor. But you're going to be speaking at the 420 celebrations, April 20th, in Windsor. What's going on with that?
I am. I've been booked in there. I want to thank Leo Lucifer for booking me in there, and my publicist, Tracy Lamore, for helping, who also helps Green Crush out. I'm going to be speaking on recreational the Friday on 420, and then on the Saturday I will be speaking about medical as well.
Fantastic. Once again, folks, this is Paul Hartman. He is a patient, among other things, and a storied history, as you know. He's a patient of Dr. Sam Malachi, who has written the book The Great Cannabis Conspiracy. We featured that at the end of February on the show with Paul, and he is carrying that torch as our Sam is working through his... Go ahead.
Absolutely. Everybody buy that book.
Yeah.
It's a great bargain, and it's a wonderful story. It is full of shock and surprise, and it's going to a great cause and a great man.
Paul.
I mean, literally, we wouldn't be where we are right now without people like Sam.
That's for sure. And I'd like you to know that I'm thrilled to know that you know him and that I know him and that I read the book and the help it's been giving me and understanding and how all this magic works. It's kind of more on the side of science than magic, and thank God we're no longer repressing it. I'm looking forward to seeing you down here.
I'm looking forward to it too, and I really enjoyed the first show, and this next one's going to be great as well. And Barry Foy, you're awesome, man. Glad we were warriors together at the same time on different coasts.
On the same time on different coasts, but I don't think you know, Barry was necessarily compacting their stuff with a garbage kitchen press. So, you know, hopefully you gave that thing a rinse before you sold somebody weed with, like, egg juice on it or something.
No, we use brand new ones. You kidding me?
I guess you could afford them. Okay, Paul, we're going to let you go.
A great product made by Sears.
And now they're out of business because there's no more smuggling.
Well, you know.
All right, we will talk to you again soon, Paul. It's been a great time on the show today. Went longer than we thought, but Barry had a ton of stuff for us to hear. So thanks a whole bunch, Paul. I'm looking forward to it. We're going to let you go and talk to you soon. Looking forward to seeing you. And it's a kind of a rainy day, but I feel very sunny inside. I'm so glad that that we have this show and we can get these pieces of information out to people. You hear about the peace and the love and the groovy, even when they were smuggling. They didn't tolerate all that hate and war and shit and all these other terrible, you know, cocaine. And, you know, do what you're going to do, but it's just a more peaceful thing to take advantage of, this cannabis plant, this thing that has turned around my life. I don't seem to be able to shake the stage 4 label. They won't take that away from me. So now I understand that I am stage 5. That's something I gave myself once I realized they weren't going to let me back out of the stage 4. So stage 5, a plant can save your life. My name is Alan Park. You've been listening to Green Crush, and I thank you for it.
We just had a rotten nightmare, that's all.